Welcome to the Besties with Breasties podcast. Sarah Hall here. I am a certified health and wellness coach, athletic trainer, mom, and breast cancer survivor. I help women overcome their own mind drama to make mind shifts that open up the possibility for their most empowered and energetic life.
And I am Beth Wilmus, author, speaker, and founder of a human investment organization, otherwise known as a nonprofit, called Faith Through Fire. Our mission is to reduce the fear and anxiety that breast cancer patients feel and replace it with hope and a path toward thriving.
This podcast is about our experiences with breast cancer
and life after as young survivors and moms.
Hello.
Hello.
It's podcast day. It's podcast day.
It feels like a minute since we've been here, but maybe that's wrong.
I do kind of feel like it's been a minute. Yeah. I don't know. Our worlds are crazy. We don't know what
I know.
You know.
What day is it?
Right. So we have a guest today.
Yay.
Yeah. We're going
to
be talking.
I'm looking forward to this guest.
I am too. I'm really interested. She's an oncologist. And we're going to be talking to her about her viewpoint on patients who are medically skeptical.
Oh, cool.
What do you think that doctors think about patients who are medically skeptical or decline certain parts of treatment? Like, do you want to go in with an assumption or do you want to just see what she has to say?
I mean, I think I really only have my experience. And I feel like whenever I bring up things that I think they're like, oh, I'm getting a whiff of medical skepticism from this girl, that they think like sort of crunchy, uneducated. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's my.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could be wrong.
Okay. I don't know how this is going to sound, but I often encounter, I don't know anything about that. Like, mm-hmm. if I say, hey, you know, I read this study that said this.
Yeah.
Or what are your thoughts about calorie restriction for mm-hmm. cancer patients? Because it seems really promising. I'm often met with, I don't, you know, like the safety net is I don't know enough about that to comment. Yeah. So just don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I could get that.
So I'm kind of interested to go down this rabbit hole with her. But I really appreciate her coming on and sharing her, you know, her viewpoints on this. So our guest today is Dr. Catherine Clifton. Dr. Clifton is board certified in internal medicine, hematology, and oncology. And her particular focus is on treating breast cancer patients as an oncologist. So she earned her MD from Loyola University School of Medicine in 2013, and then followed it with a hematology oncology fellowship at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And currently, she serves as an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at Washington University here in St. Louis, Missouri.
Ooch, ooch. So she's a local.
She is.
Nice.
So first, we're going to talk to her about survival rates of patients who do treatment versus those who don't or decline certain portions.
And then we're going to talk about the common reasons or concerns Dr. Clifton hears when patients decline certain treatments.
Yep. Her thoughts about why more MDs aren't incorporating existing research into current cancer care.
And then finally, we'll discuss how she balances medical recommendations with considerations for a patient's quality of life.
All right. But before we dive in with Dr. Clifton, let's hear from our first sponsor. Ann's Bra Shop features skilled mastectomy fitters ready to assist you in selecting the perfect breast forms, bras, swimsuits, and camisoles for your post-surgery needs. They have three locations in the St. Louis area, Chesterfield and Wentzville, Missouri, across the river in O'Fallon, Illinois, and a fourth location south on I-55 in Cape Girardeau. Visit Ann's Bra Shop at www.brashop.com to learn more. Well, welcome, Dr. Clifton. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah and I were really excited to talk with you. We're in the middle of a medical skepticism series, and I want to know what it's like dealing with cancer patients who maybe have some medical skepticism or who are questioning certain portions of treatment. Like, what's that like as an oncologist?
So I think we do see a lot of medical skepticism, you know, not just on oncology, but in medicine in general, you know, these days. I think, you know, with the internet and things like that, it is on the rise. I think, you know, and we can see a fair bit in oncology because, you know, I'm sure I hear a lot from patients when they're diagnosed with a cancer that they suddenly meet all these other people who have had cancer or know someone that has cancer. And so everyone wants to share their stories or their advice. And I think from that can come some issues about skepticism. So I think for me as an oncologist, the first thing that I like to do is try to really talk to the patient and kind of delve into, you know, what is behind the skepticism? You know, is it a history with a them personally or a family member who has had a bad experience with the healthcare system? Is it things that they've read online? Is it, you know, things someone else told them? Is it coming from a place of, you know, understandable worry or fear about the diagnosis? So kind of like really what's behind the skepticism. And I think that is always a helpful place to start.
So do you see a theme with patients and where their medical skepticism usually comes from? Because with Faith Through Fire, I tend to see some themes reoccur quite often. And I'd be curious to see if you felt the same, like in terms of where most people are coming from with that.
Yeah. I think there are definitely different themes. That's a great point. So I think one thing that I can see a lot is a patient who has had, you know, a family member or a friend who maybe had a cancer diagnosis where, you know, and unfortunately things did not go well, or, you know, and that could be maybe that patient was treated 20 or 30 years ago, you know, when we didn't have as many supportive care medications, or, you know, we didn't have as many treatment options and things were different. Mm. Or it can be, you know, a completely different diagnosis. You know, I'm sure as you all know that, you know, there's many different types of breast cancer, and breast cancer can also, even if it's the same type, it can behave differently. So hearing someone else's story, you know, about a different cancer or a different breast cancer that went differently, I think that can also cause confusion and skepticism.
That's an interesting point, because we had two people that we talked to recently. One was an actual patient. She declined treatment because her best friend died of leukemia the year prior. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she was with her from start to finish and basically her caregiver. And so that immediately for her was just like, I'm not doing this. And so mm-hmm. when she got her own cancer diagnosis, and I thought that was really interesting that the trauma from her personal experience with her friend informed her own decision making. And then mm-hmm. she became metastatic. And then we had another gentleman just recently reach out to our nonprofit because his wife was completely refusing treatment. And that was based largely on her experience with her mother, who had mm-hmm. died of breast cancer. Now, the patient was like in her 70s. So her mother, think about how long ago her mother went through the mm-hmm. the treatment process. So we do see that quite a bit, mm-hmm. that when people have lived experience with cancer, they often choose a much different path for themselves.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably one of the bigger ones. And then I think, you know, just in addition to that, seeking to try alternative therapies, you know, comes up a lot. So, you know, patients have this concern about, you know, the treatments that we may be offering. And then as a result, they're looking, you know, for something else, maybe with less side effects. I think kind of as we were talking about, right, when someone has a cancer diagnosis, a lot of people come out from everywhere about different things that worked for them, different things that helped. And I think, unfortunately, you know, cancer patients, it's a vulnerable time. And there's lots of things on the internet, lots of things you can read about these, you know, miracle cures, which would be great. But, you know, sometimes I think you can be in a vulnerable place, and seeing these stories or, you know, about these amazing cures or miraculous discoveries, which unfortunately might not be always, you know, based in science, people can kind of go down that route as well.
Do you think that people can cure themselves naturally through lifestyle changes, doctor?
I think lifestyle changes are you know, and lifestyle is such an important part of medicine in general and in oncology. And it's something that historically, I think the medical community has not done a great job focusing on. And I think we're getting better focusing about how much the lifestyle choices we make do impact our cancer diagnosis or cancer treatment, or, you know, how we, you know, the survivorship period. But I do think, you know, everyone's cancer is different. And what I tell people is just, you know, lifestyle changes in and of themselves can't be necessarily the whole picture for a lot of breast cancers, you know. So I think trying to substitute a lifestyle change for a needed surgery for an early stage breast cancer, you know, I think those are things we wouldn't recommend. Doing lifestyle changes in conjunction with something like surgery, that's always something that we encourage. And I should say by lifestyle changes, I mean kind of diet, exercise, minimal alcohol use, not smoking, you know, not
management.
Really talking about things like, yeah. Exactly. Not talking about like herbal remedies or things like that, but kind of just more of the...
I agree with you, doctor, like in terms of there needs to be a more of a dialogue, I think, with patients. I think that a lot of patients, to your point, are so traumatized when they get the news that they have cancer that the healthcare community is very hesitant to tell them that lifestyle played a part in their diagnosis. I think Sarah and I as survivors, I mean, we were both diagnosed very young. We both thought we were healthy. I can look back in retrospect and know that I wasn't doing what I needed to be doing for my health. And I can take ownership of that now. I think it's hard for, you know, doctors to tell patients, like, listen, you got to make some major changes here. This is your body's wake up call to you that something's not good here. And I do think that that conversation needs to be happening more because, you know, to your point, diet and movement and stress. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the number of women that we encounter who get diagnosed right after a very stressful or traumatic event in their life is astounding. And I just I just can't imagine that it's not related, you know, that the immune system function isn't related to that lack of stress management. And so I think that was a big contributing factor for myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, why do you think those conversations aren't happening in conjunction with medical care for cancer patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So I think twofold, you know, just like you were saying, I think, you know, as a medical community and as a physician who's you know, talking to someone about their cancer, it can feel, you know, it's a hard conversation to have. And we definitely don't want to place blame on anyone for lifestyle factors that, you know, may have potentially contributed, you know, and I always tell people, right, like it's not just one thing that caused your cancer. It's usually, you know, a multitude of things, but, you know, it can feel awkward and we don't want anyone to feel guilty. But like you said, going from there, I think after the cancer diagnosis, we do try to have these conversations, at least I do in my clinic about, and I think it can be empowering for patients about, okay, now that you have this diagnosis, a lot of these lifestyle things that are outside of your control after a cancer diagnosis, but taking ownership, as you're saying, and taking control of these lifestyle things is something that you can focus on. I think historically the medical community, you know, it's easier, right, to tell someone take this pill because we think that might be, you know, easier for them to do rather than, you know, making some serious lifestyle changes like, okay, I want you to exercise more, change your diet, really cut back or abstain from alcohol use. Those things can be a little bit of a more difficult conversation. But I think those conversations do need to happen. And it needs to be emphasized that we can do both, right? We don't just have to pick one or the other.
I always think of exercise in particular, or movement, as we say, because we don't want people to be scared off by the word exercise. But it's like, exactly, when you exactly. look at the lower, what the recurrence rates are for somebody that exercises, you know, post-diagnosis or even pre-diagnosis versus those that don't, it's kind of astounding. I mean, I think it's like upwards of 50 to 60%. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hopeful. You know, if we have those conversations at time of diagnosis, you know, now granted, when you're doing chemo, you're not going to be out necessarily jog in the neighborhood. Some people do. but you know, I mean, even just a small walk, not only does that help with your recurrence rates, but it's also going to make you handle the symptoms of chemotherapy much better. So I just think there's such an opportunity for those kind of conversations to empower people to feel like they're an active participant of their care. And maybe that would go to alleviating some of the fear. But I also think that there's a lot of people, and Sarah, I'd be curious what you think about this. There's just so many people who have this level of medical skepticism of, as a society, we have come to rely on drugs to fix problems that have root causes. And so we're really just masking symptoms. We're not addressing root causes. And the system's not really set up to help you uncover those root causes. You know,
I do wish I remember specifically a conversation that I had with my oncologist, because I was most scared of taking my AI or my tamoxifen. I ended up on tamoxifen because, you know, some history, obviously, like just like we were talking about, I was most scared because I watched somebody else go through it and it was awful for them. And so when I brought up my concerns, I guess something that I wished, and maybe part of what breeds a little bit of my medical skepticism, is that instead of the response from my concerns being like, oh, I mean, there are lifestyle things that you can bring in, we can do this, we can do that for, you know, your concerns about being on these drugs, it was like, oh, honey, it's okay, we have drugs for any symptoms you have. And I think I was like, oh, great. That's exactly the other direction.
But do you think you're the typical patient, Sarah?
No, I don't. I think this conversation is interesting because, Catherine, right from the beginning, you're like, I like to dig in and ask where those skepticisms are coming from. And even just asking one or two questions about, like, you know, getting to know your patient a little bit more will kind of dictate how you are able to communicate with them in a way of like, I know that my first interaction with, they have this medical skepticism from this in their history. I know that, like, saying that probably not be helpful for them. It actually might work the other way. So I think what's missing and what could potentially help out with some of this, you know, planting the seeds of medical skepticism is just like getting to know your patients a little bit better.
Yeah. I mean, that's really tough in the current system.
I know.
I mean, Dr. Clifton, you know that. You know,
wave a magic wand.
I know. You know that better than anybody. But I mean, it's just, it's becoming increasingly difficult to really have, you know, that time. Mm-hmm. To do that. But I agree. I mean, I think, you know, for me, some of my medical skepticism came in when, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to have radiation over my heart. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the chances that I'm going to have heart problems or, you know, heart failure mm-hmm. as a result of doing this? And the answer was not, there wasn't really an answer. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be a question that I wanted to ask you, Dr. Clifton, is like, you know, success in oncology is measured in, are you still alive 5 years later? And I'm wondering how often patients are followed beyond that 5 years and whether quality of life issues that are a result of treatment is taken into consideration. You know, is that a consideration when you're dealing with a patient like, okay, yes, are we thinking about cognitive decline or lymphedema or taking their ovaries out and them having dry, painful sex or the, you know, getting rid of estrogen, which is brain protective and heart protective and neuropathy? Are these things that are being thought of, you know, when considering recommendations for patients? Because it seems like younger patients in particular, like Sarah and I, they're kind of throwing the book at it because the idea is to get us past that 5 years. And quality of life is kind of a secondary notion. And I think that a lot of people feel medical skepticism after treatment because they're left with all of these problems that they didn't have before. And then they start questioning, should I have done this? Or they made decisions when they were in a traumatized state and they were scared. And there's a little bit of regret there. So can you speak to some of that and how that's handled within a clinical setting?
Yeah, definitely. No, I think that's a great point because I think historically in oncology, we've had, you know, unfortunately such, you know, few options previously, such few options to offer patients that it was just kind of the thought was, well, this is what we have, you know, and we'll go from there. And like you said, you know, our goal is just to keep you alive. And now I think as we are having, which is a good thing, more treatment options to offer patients. I think as we have been doing this longer and longer, there is, you know, this shift to focus on patient-reported outcomes. And now it's becoming a very important part of clinical trials. So including not just, okay, who is alive or whose cancer is back or not back after, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, but, you know, what percentage of patients have debilitating neuropathy or, you know, what patients continue to have fatigue after several years. You know, the whole idea of brain fog and cognitive impairment out of treatment is really, you know, just coming into being understood. And we're, you know, definitely a long way away from finding effective treatments for it. But it's, you know, now it's at least being acknowledged as, you know, a symptom from these treatments and something that we really need to monitor and get better and find better ways to treat it. So I think as an oncology community, we're coming around to, we need to focus not just on keeping patients alive, but also what their quality of life is. Because like, as you said, we don't want to have you be here 5 years from now, but, you know, have a poor quality of life because then, you know, did we really help you that much?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a doctor in the media that made headlines. I think it's Dr. Emmanuel Ezekiel, and he's an oncologist. And he made headlines because he penned this article about how if he made it to his 70s, he would decline treatment if he got cancer. And as an oncologist saying this, I thought that was super interesting. And then he was very unapologetic about it when he interviewed. He said, listen, my quality of life is more important to me than prolonging. So longevity mm-hmm. versus quality of life. Mm-hmm. And he was choosing quality of life. And of course, his family didn't like it. And, you know, they were like, you're going to change your mind when you get there. And he's like, I'm not going to take these preventative, you know, these pills to kind of increase my lifespan if it comes at a sacrifice of my quality of life. And I thought that was really interesting because I think he's saying what a lot of patients feel. And I mean, patients sometimes do decline treatment because they're like, I would rather live my life and roll the dice. Now, do they come to regret that? I don't know. You know, but that's why at Faith Through Fire, we our job is to not tell patients what to do. Our job is to support them no matter what they choose. But we do always tell them that they have to make the choice that's best for them, because if they let other people influence them, it's going to lead to resentment or regret. So as long as you know the stakes and you feel comfortable with it, mm-hmm. you know, everybody has to step off the ledge in cancer care at some point. You know, I did 5 years of drug therapy. And at the end of the five, they're like, well, maybe you should do another five, even though the test didn't indicate it might benefit. And I thought, no, I'm ready to step off the cliff. Like, I'm going to just do it. You know, my quality of life is more important at this point. So I want to dive into an interesting topic that I really want to pick your brain about. But before we do that, I head there, let's do Boobs in the News.
Let's do it.
Boobs in the News is a fun segment where we read funny tweets by real people or ridiculous news stories.
Boobs in the News! Boobs in the News! Boobs in the News!
Okay, so this was kind of funny. This was by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that put this up. And it says, what are you starting to dislike as you get older? And then ask for people's comments.
Joint pain.
These people are cranky. I'll go out on a ledge and say that. But the first person said the general population.
Oh my gosh.
Somebody said,
talking about, I have a bleak outlook on humanity.
I know. Somebody did say marijuana stench. And I will tell you,
you and your marijuana.
Well,
thing.
No. So my husband and I went to Nashville recently and had the best time, but we couldn't go anywhere without being slapped in the face with like the smell. It's strong.
I honestly would rather walking into marijuana smell than to walk into smoke.
Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So this person said social media, most people, grocery stores, television, loud noise, and the stickers that are placed on fruit.
Oh my, wow, that's silly.
I actually really appreciate the stickers on the fruit
because it has a code. Checkout now, and you've got to put those codes in.
You got to put those codes in. So when there's a sticker on the fruit, I'm excited. When there's no sticker, I get mad.
Do you think people put things like grocery store because now, like, I don't think we would ever.
Now you have to check yourself out?
Well, no. I mean, yes, now you have to check yourself out, but like, but now there's things like Instacart. And so we've smelled the other side where it's like, I have to do no work. And now they get annoyed when they have to do any work.
Oh, I do agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. There's your boobs.
Boobs in the News. Boobs in the News. Boobs in the News.
Okay. And we're back. I want to get your thoughts on this, Dr. Clifton. So it seems like there's a difference, and a lot of patients don't understand the difference between medical doctors and PhD research. And so it seems to me we have these two different groups of people. We've got scientists who are doing research on cancer care. And then we have medical doctors who are kind of following the FDA. They're working within these hospital systems with specific protocols for different treatments. And we don't see a ton of MDs. They're doing it more and more. But we're not seeing a ton of them incorporate research that's out there now that might indicate that it improves outcomes for patients without long-term clinical trials or FDA approval. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, because there seems to be some interesting data out there about cancer as a metabolic disease versus genetic disease, or cancer calorie restriction or fasting as a means to improve the efficacy of treatment. Yeah. I mean, these things have been pretty exciting as a cancer patient to look at them and say, wow, this looks really promising. And yet it seems like medical doctors are very reluctant. And I'm wondering what the thought process is there.
Yeah, those are great points, because I do have, you know, like a lot of patients will come to us with exciting research. I think it is important to emphasize that there are a lot of exciting, you know, breakthroughs, discoveries that are going on in oncology. I think some of our hesitations, you know, as medical physicians treating patients, is that some of these discoveries are currently limited to the lab setting. You know, so sometimes this will be, okay, it's a very exciting, promising, but it's only been studied in mice, or it's only been studied in a small amount of patients. And so I always tell people, this is really exciting. And maybe in 5 to 10 years, hopefully this science will continue to advance and we'll know more. But, you know, when studies are still kind of confined to, you know, preclinical, so, you know, before they've been tested in humans, or even if they've been tested in, you know, a small amount of patients, you know, we do know that, you know, historically there have been things that looked exciting in those settings, but then when they're tested in a larger amount, you know, more patients, a bigger patient population, then unfortunately it hasn't panned out. So I think that's where a lot of, you know, we can be concerned about, you know, maybe too prematurely recommending that patients follow these, you know, follow these new exciting things before they're tested in a larger population or before they've been, you know, incorporated into the guidelines. So I think that can be where some of our concerns kind of end up lying. I think it's really exciting, and we hope that, you know, and I always tell people, I hope that in, you know, 5-10 years, I would feel more comfortable recommending those things. But, you know, at this point, if it's still only been tested, you know, in the lab, in mice, in a really small amount of patients, hopefully we'll know more to come. But until that point, I, you know, feel like I can't confidently recommend it.
I think that can feel, just as a cancer patient, I think that can feel really heavy when we kind of know that the FDA process is not historically quick. And when you're in the middle of a diagnosis and kind of grasping on anything that you know, that feels hopeful. And, you know, some of the research has been out there for, you know, a little bit longer than, you know, just a couple mice lab trials, but it just kind of gets stuck on the floor of the FDA. Like, I think that's where it gets a little bit overwhelming.
Or I think patients are skeptical because it's like, who's going to invest money in fasting?
Right.
You know, there's no money to be made there. And that's what you hear from patients a lot of times is there's no money in vitamin D. There's no money in fasting.
Yeah.
And what is the medical community going to do when those wells dry up? And, you know, and I think that's, you know, I don't know if that's fair to have this assumption that they want people sick so that they can make money. But it does seem strange that when there's no, you know, you would think, for example, fasting, there's no adverse drug effects, you know, that you're going to have to worry about with something like that. And it just seems strange to me that the FDA can't fast track something like that. I don't know. You know more about that, Dr. Clifton, than we do. But coming from like the patient side, that's the kind of conversations that patients have behind closed doors that lead them feeling like, I'm not being told everything that I need to know.
So I'm curious if you do have a patient that comes through and they, you know, they're considering their options and you've presented, you know, the treatment that you're recommending and they're like leaning more on the, you know, I'm potentially choosing quality of life and I might, you know, choose not to do treatment. Is there instances where you are open to sharing some of the research on things like fasting or the things that are not potentially drug related that are lifestyle changes? Or like, how does that conversation look? Or is there somebody that you kind of like pass them off to?
Sure, definitely. So I think, you know, it can be hard because I think, as you all know, right, that there's many different, you know, parts of cancer care. So, you know, if someone is looking to completely forego surgery for like a natural cure, you know, those decisions we do become more concerned about. Granted, I always tell people, right, it's just my job to make a recommendation. Ultimately, we never can force you to do any part of treatment. It's ultimately your decision. Where the decision to do lifestyle alone comes up a lot more, you know, obviously, as you all know, the most common type of breast cancer we see is the hormone receptor positive breast cancer, you know, and as you all know, those patients are all recommended either like the aromatase inhibitor or the tamoxifen, usually for at least 5 years. And as you all know, those can have lots of side effects. And so that's where I can see a lot of times patients choosing to, you know, especially if they had a very small tumor, choosing to forego those treatments. And then that's when I tell them, obviously, I still would recommend those treatments if they're not going to, but we do know that lifestyle, as we were saying, it, you know, it is really important. And that's where I kind of go through and review the recommendations from, you know, places like the American Cancer Society of, you know, what's important, what are things that they can be doing from a lifestyle standpoint.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Before we kind of wrap up with everything, let's hear from our second sponsor.
Thrivent is a proud sponsor of Faith Through Fire. Thrivent believes money is a tool and not a goal. The Gateway Financial Group with Thrivent is local to the St. Louis area and can work with you to create a financial strategy that reflects your priorities and helps you protect the things that matter to you, like family and giving back. Please call 314-783-4214 to schedule a free consultation with one of Thrivent's Gateway Financial Advisors. All right, we are back. I would love to hear kind of any final words you have for, I know when you kind of get that cancer diagnosis, there's so much that goes through your mind. First of all, you're kind of hit with the trauma of the diagnosis, but I think the whole point of this series and the whole point of this conversation is just to let people know that, you know, those options are out there and that the medical community obviously sees when you have those reservations and how that's kind of being handled. But do you have any final words to sort of leave our audience with?
I think having those discussions with your oncologist is so important. You know, letting them know what your reservations are, and then, you know, trying to engage them and explain, you know, why you have those reservations, because, you know, potentially the oncologist can offer hopefully some words of relief. Like, you know, a lot of people, when they think about chemotherapy, they think about, you know, they're really worried about nausea and vomiting, and that might be from people that they heard who had chemo 20, 30 years ago, or what they've seen on television. You know, and we do have, you know, better anti-nausea medicines these days. So if you're just able to, that's just one example, but bring up your concerns to your oncologist, and then try to engage them and have that dialogue and conversation. And I think the other thing is to try to find, you know, one or two support people who can definitely, you know, help you go through the diagnosis. But I think it could be overwhelming to be just listening to many, many people share their stories and advices. And if that feels too overwhelming, you know, just to focus on your one or two support people. And I also tell people, you know, be careful what they read on the internet, you know.
Yeah, Dr. Google is like a real, I mean, you know, and I will say that, I mean, we tell patients like, it's best not to Google when you get newly diagnosed. That's a very scary rabbit hole to go down. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's no, you know, knowing what you're reading or if it's accurate. So reputable sources, right?
Reputable sources, going through support groups, maybe through your oncologist's office, you know, a reputable support group. You know, I always tell people caution, places like Facebook support groups can be helpful, but they can also not be helpful. So trying to, like, just like you said, go through those, you know, reputable sources, so that you're getting good information. And then, you know, if you have reservations about things that come up from those sources, talking to your oncologist about that.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye. Until next time, guys.
See ya.
Thank you for being a listener of the Besties with Breasties podcast. If this podcast had a positive impact on your journey, leave us a review or consider becoming a supporter. You can donate with the link in the show notes or at faiththroughfire.org. This episode was hosted by Sarah Hall and Beth Wilmes, audio and production edits by Innovative Frequencies.